cancer epidemiologist Diana Sarfati is the new interim national director of cancer control. It's part of the cancer action plan announced this week. Professor Sarfati is head of the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago. She's led research into ethnic disparities in cancer outcomes for a long, long time, and she says this plan is a turning point in New Zealand's approach to cancer. No decisions have been made yet about resource requirements or allocations. Neither do we know who's going to be on the board. But the ambitious goal is to make outcomes for Māori equitable by 2030. Māori are 20% more likely to get cancer, nearly twice as likely to die from it. Professor Diana Sarfati is with me now. Morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What have all these years of research into inequitable outcomes told you about what needs to be done?
Well, it's really interesting because when I started this work, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the sort of received wisdom was that the issues were that, you know, Māori weren't turning up to their doctor, they weren't recognising symptoms, they were, you know, they were declining treatment. It was all about what they weren't doing. And what this research has shown is that's not the case. The issues are relating to the system. And what we've found is, you know, there's not one place in the system where the problem is. There's no one thing that you can fix and that will have it sorted. I know, because that would be easier. But it's more that there's little differences at each step. So if you look at each step of the process, the difference between Māori and non-Māori will only be very small, but the cumulative effect across an entire system becomes large. So it is a systems issue.
And yet you've been saying this for a long time.
Yes.
And you've done all this research for a long time. Why has nothing changed?
Well, I think what we have to really be clear about is in order to address these issues, we have to be working in very close partnership with Māori. And that will be one of my ambitions for this new structure, is to have a really clear partnership model with Māori, because Māori are going to be able to identify both what some of the issues are and the solutions are from a perspective that others can't.
Mm. Why do you think that a national plan, which presumably is going to take certain things out of the hands of the DHBs, is going to be part of the solution?
Well, what we have now is a very regional approach to cancer care and cancer control. So you've got regional cancer networks and then DHBs making decisions and plans around cancer for their own regions. And of course that leads to variations. So you have some DHBs who are doing very well and some DHBs who are doing less well. And so what we'd be wanting to do is identifying the differences between those two DHBs, finding out what the DHBs that are getting really good outcomes are doing, and then supporting those DHBs who are doing less well, you know, to lift their game.
You don't think the mere fact that we have 20 DHBs is indeed part of the problem?
Well, I think that for cancer, which is incredibly complex, you know, it's very, very, it really encompasses the entire health system. You have to have central leadership. You have to be thinking about this at a national level. And I think if you don't do that, there is a danger of variations in outcomes and, you know, pockets of less good quality care.
You're going to have to be looking at Pharmac as well?
Well, Pharmac's not part of the Ministry of Health, so I'll be working within the Ministry of Health. Obviously, I'm very interested in access to drugs for patients with cancer. I'm really pleased that, well, A, that Pharmac has had a funding boost.
A bit.
But also that they are looking at their processes in terms of speeding up their processes and making their decisions more transparent. And of course, I'll be wanting to talk to them as part of the whole process of thinking about how we deal with cancer.
I mean, the fact is that, between 2011 and 2017, 24 new cancer drugs were funded in Australia, but not here in New Zealand. That's got to have some impact on cancer outcomes, right?
So I'm really interested in the entire, you know, right across the whole cancer treatment spectrum.
Yes.
If we're just thinking about treatment. And of course, drugs play a really important role, and they play a particularly important role for some particular cancers, you know, blood cancers, for example, really critical for that. But if you think about where we get our cancer cures, our cancer controls from, about 90% of that is in early diagnosis, radiotherapy, surgery. So while drugs are really critical, it's really important to be looking across the whole thing and making sure we are investing in the areas where we're most likely to get maximum benefit.
Let me ask you this, because you're a cancer epidemiologist. I presume you can answer it. I don't know.
Well, I will. Yeah, I
Give it a crack. Keytruda.
Yes.
In New Zealand is not funded for lung cancer, but is for melanoma. A lot of people with lung cancer say this is not fair. Is it that Keytruda is not effective for lung cancer, not as effective for lung cancer? What would the story be there?
Yeah, I think that I would not be the best person to answer that question. That's a I'm not a clinician, and so I might get myself into hot water if I try and address that question. But certainly drugs, when you're looking at the drugs and what cancers they work for, there obviously can be differences in terms of their effectiveness. I don't know the specifics around Keytruda in terms of lung cancer.
It does. I mean, the cry is, this is not fair, but there may be reasons for
there
it.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it ever possible to avoid what's been called postcode lottery in terms of cancer treatment? There's always going to be people living in certain parts of the country on top of mountains and in valleys, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Who are
yes.
going to find it harder to get treatment.
Yes.
That's a fact of life, isn't it?
So what we want to be doing is, I think you are actually correct, that there is likely to be a some level of difference because of those things. If you're living, you know, in a distant island somewhere, it's going to take you a long time to get into town. But what we're trying to do is get rid of the postcode lottery, which is not reasonable, is not explainable by remoteness or anything else. So we're looking at where there is variations in what's offered DHB by DHB, or differences in, for example, adverse outcomes following surgery, for example, that we would expect those to be similar in different areas. And where they're not, we're wanting to look at why.
Outcomes after treatment is one thing. Outcomes for lack of treatment is one thing, but what about the increased or the greater incidence of certain cancers among Māori?
Yeah, so I mean that's something that I'm really passionate about, because whilst Māori, they have about a 20% higher incidence overall, but the cancers where they have much greater incidence tend to be very lethal cancers and also very preventable cancers. So, for example, lung cancer, stomach cancer, liver cancer, these are all highly preventable cancers.
Well, lung cancer, obviously, don't smoke.
Yes.
Stomach cancer?
So stomach cancer is a really interesting one. So there are two elements to the high rates of stomach cancer among Māori. One is there is a whānau that has a genetic
predisposition.
Yes, that's right. And so that's some of it. But the majority of the difference is due to different rates of infection with a bacterium called H. pylori.
Is that the one that causes ulcers?
It causes ulcers.
Now we know.
Yes, and it's a very common infection. So, I mean, if people know that they have H. pylori, don't be starting to think that this is, you know, next minute you're going to develop stomach cancer. That's absolutely
How
not
would
the
you
case.
Know if you had it?
Well, a lot of people wouldn't know they had it. Sometimes people get symptoms, you know, sort of an indigestion and those sorts of things. But by and large, people don't know they have it. It's very common. The rates of H. pylori are actually coming down over time, so that's good. But the rates of H. pylori among Māori and Pacific are very much higher. And we know that about 90% of the cancers that occur in the distal part of the stomach, so that's this part of the stomach which is away from the esophagus, a bit further away, so 90% of those cancers are caused by H. pylori infection. And the really interesting thing about H. pylori infection is you tend to get infected with it young, when you're a child, most commonly, or young adult. And it's more common if you're living in overcrowded conditions, for example. So this is really a cancer of poverty. And when you think about childhood overcrowding and childhood poverty, you know, you don't think about stomach cancer in 15, 60-year-olds decades later. So, you know, you really have to be thinking quite broadly about some of these issues.
Why does H. pylori cause stomach cancer and sometimes ulcers? Or yeah. are they the same thing eventually?
It basically causes chronic infection. It sort of causes, chronic inflammation.
Ah.
You know, so which is a risk factor for sort of cancer change in the stomach. But the majority of people with H. pylori don't go on to develop stomach cancer. It's a little bit like HPV with cervical cancer. You know, a lot of women have HPV infection and very few go on to develop cervical cancer.
You said that prevention is the key.
Yeah.
So we've talked about lung cancer and smoking. We've talked about stomach cancer among Māori. What are you going to do? That's living conditions, that's poverty.
Well, yeah, actually with HPV, H. pylori, there is some emerging evidence that screening and treating for H. pylori can reduce future risk of stomach cancer. So this is really quite new evidence from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, who are now advocating that this is a good idea for populations that have high rates of H. pylori. So it wouldn't be something you would do for a general population, but if there are subpopulations that have high rates of H. pylori, so you can screen, and then antibiotic treatment for H. pylori, which then reduces your future risk of stomach cancer.
Would you like to see that?
Well, there are
specific population screening for H. pylori.
I would really like to see that seriously considered. There's some issues that need to be thought through. So, for example, as with all screening or any other population, you know, intervention, there are potential harms. So we have to think about what are
you
the
mean
harms.
False positive, false negative.
Well, that, but also, mass treatment with antibiotics and whether clearing. There's some evidence that if you treat H. pylori, it may, for reasons which aren't entirely clear, increase your risk of esophageal cancer, for example.
Oh,
so,
Lord.
You know, everything, you know, is more complicated.
Yes, isn't it, though?
But at the moment, the evidence is suggesting that it's likely to be helpful, but we do just have to think through some of these issues before we jump in, you know, hook, line and sinker.
You've got so many balls to juggle, right?
Yes.
Because the cancers, they're so different, they require different treatments, there's screening, there's not screening. There's an argument at the moment that we need different mammogram machines to screen, because the machines that we have are not picking up tumours or cancers in extremely dense breast tissue. And this means a lot of false negatives and consequently a lot of deaths that could have been apprehended. Do you have a view on that?
Well, I mean, I think a couple of points to note there that we have a high quality breast cancer screening program. We're doing well on an international compared with other countries. The issue here, and I guess with cancer in general, is there's a lot of potential new technologies that may improve outcomes for some patients, but everything has to be balanced against everything else. And so it's sort of in that group of things that we have to think about when we think about broadly, where do we invest? You know, where do we invest in terms of cancer control?
You're talking about scarce resources.
Scarce resources, exactly.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I am.
So what you're saying is we can't afford machines that can detect cancers in maybe 10% of women.
Well, I'm not specifically saying that. I'm saying that whenever we look at investment for cancer, we have to look across. We have to look at the entire picture so that we're investing where we're going to get best bang for buck. So the director of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, who's just stepped down, he used to say a lot, no country can afford to treat their way out of cancer because of this. There's no country in the world. I mean, every country's facing this. There's hugely expensive, you know, drugs and new technologies coming all the time. The pace of change is such that it's very difficult for health systems to, you know, keep up with it. And so it's a constant challenge to look at these kind of new interventions and think which ones of these should we be, you know, taking up.
It was your organisation at the Cancer Care at the Crossroads earlier this year.
Yes.
Which kind of kicked the National Cancer Action Plan into shape. Were you at all disappointed that it wasn't a standalone?
Well, I think there's some advantages of having the agency within the ministry. So I think if you look, this exact structure of the agency has yet to be determined, and it will be in place from the 1st of December, as you know. So we don't know what it's going to look like here. But if you look internationally, cancer agencies tend to, you know, they pull together all the elements of cancer control. So, you know, you've got your cancer prevention and your cancer screening and your cancer registries and cancer treatment and all of that all pulled together so it can be coordinated. The advantage of having a unit like that within the ministry is there's also other parts of the ministry which are very closely aligned with cancer but are not purely cancer. So for example, surgical services, absolutely critical, sitting within the ministry, but allows us to have close links with those sorts of groups, or primary care. You know, so it does provide an approach which allows closer links with the rest of the health system.
Would you have preferred a standalone agency?
I genuinely think that there are advantages and disadvantages of both approaches, and I'm delighted that we have an approach which is going to allow us to have strong central leadership and a really coordinated approach. We've got, between now and 2040, two decades, we're expecting a doubling of cancer cases. That's a really big increase in our burden. So we need to be strategic and be thinking quite carefully about this. So I'm just really pleased that we've got something that will allow us to do that.
You've made a study, I want to come back to your relationship with the Ministry of Health in a moment, but you've made a study of the NHS reforms in the UK that was specifically to address cancer inequalities. What was done there and why didn't it work?
Well, their focus was on... Well, I felt that their focus was very much on patients. So it was about letting people know about cancer symptoms, for example. It was about, health literacy and things like that. There was much less focus on what the system was doing to actually address inequalities. And what we know is usually these things are more related to the systems and the patients. And so it didn't come as a surprise to me that meant the initiatives that they put in place didn't have an impact on inequalities. So my focus would be much more about making the system work better for patients than making the patients work better for the system, if you like.
All right. You produced a study, co-authored a study that came out a couple of years back, 3 years, which suggested that midwife-led care resulted in poorer outcomes for babies than doctor-led care. And it was a call to examine the system and how it was delivery, as it were. The Ministry of Health was resistant. It reportedly tried to explain away the results or discredit it. Given that friction between you and the ministry, and it was friction, correct?
Yeah, that was a difficult phase.
It was friction. Will this make your job harder?
Oh, no. I have a very good relationship with the ministry on the whole. That particular episode was a difficult one. It was a complex issue. It's a highly emotional issue. And I think the ministry acknowledged that their management of that particular issue was not optimal.
Do they?
Yes. Yes, they have acknowledged that, and they've moved forward, and they are working now at looking at the systems. So, I'm really comfortable about that, and I'm really comfortable at working. I've been working much more closely with the cancer team and people working in the cancer space within the ministry. The work that I did on the maternity system was with a midwife who was working with me at that time. Obviously, the overlap was relating to health systems and how systems work. But my primary focus has always been cancer, and I've got a very good relationship with the ministry. I've sat on many ministry cancer-related committees and boards and things, for example.
Indeed you have, but we're still talking about systems and what that inquiry into midwife-led care was about was an examination of a system that had been going since 1990, the first real examination of a system. And the Ministry of Health was so resistant that you wonder how it can be in charge of anything.
Well, I think what's really fantastic here is we've got a commitment from actually both this government and the opposition saying that we need to have good, clear leadership in cancer, so focusing in on cancer systems in particular. So there's really strong support for that. The ministry's now developed this cancer plan, which is, again, focused on taking a systems approach. So they're starting in a place of, you know, trying to make things better. So I'm really confident that the ministry is behind this and that we will, you know, we will be working to improve the systems.
Is there anywhere in the world that's done something that we can learn from in this area?
Yeah, there's lots of countries that have cancer agencies or similar, and that there's various models inside ministries, outside ministries. Most countries have that are doing well have those kinds of organisations, which is one of the reasons why we were advocating for that when we put together the Cancer and Crossroads Conference. So we've been working closely actually with the group in Canada and groups in Australia and others, Denmark, all of whom have those sorts of agencies, and finding out from them what has worked well and what hasn't worked well. And, you know, it's useful to learn lessons from overseas where things are going well.
We talked about screening. What would you like to see screened more?
Well, so we've got three screening programs that are up and running or are being up and run, I guess. So we've got the breast screening, cervical screening and bowel screening being rolled out now. I'm highly supportive of all those three. I guess the two next ones on the horizon which need to be considered would be potential for lung cancer screening. That screening, again, this is for consideration because there's major cost implications and resource implications. But lung cancer screening is specifically for people who have a history of heavy smoking, so it's not a wouldn't be for everyone. It involves CT scans, so it's quite a resource intensive screening program, but it would be a very pro-equity screening program. So that would be one to consider. And the other one is the one that we talked about earlier on, thinking about whether we should be doing a screen and treat for H. pylori, which would also be a very pro-equity screening program.
Yep. Some people say, why cancer? Why does cancer get special treatment? I'm just reading one text at the moment. Why does cancer get special treatment over other equally serious groups of disease?
Yeah, and I think the reason why cancer stands out alone, there's several reasons. One, it's the leading cause of death in New Zealand. Two, it is uniquely complex, and the costs of care and the pace of change of treatment is such that it presents special challenges to our systems and services in a way that no other condition does. We have major inequalities in relation to cancer, so we have Māori with double the death rates, which is also true for other conditions. But also, cancer control impacts on every element of the healthcare system, and again, in a way that most conditions don't do. So and really it touches on everything, you know, primary care, diagnostics, medicine, surgery, radiotherapy, palliative care, you know, it's really everything. So it is uniquely complex. It does need to be very carefully managed.
As uniquely complex as it is, and each cancer within, you wonder whether it can even be treated as one disease. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I think it's sort of an end-to-end situation there. You can have some systems in place which work well across cancers. For example, having quality indicators and measuring against them and finding out where the gaps are, for example. So you can have common processes, but the specifics within those processes are going to be very cancer-specific. And there may be some other elements when you look at a particular cancer that we need to be, you know, different things that we do for different cancers as well. So it's sort of and, some common threads as well as some unique elements for specific cancers.
How did you become a cancer epidemiologist? I mean, why?
Well, I'm a medical doctor, so I worked with cancer patients and actually worked in palliative care for a while as well, which I really loved. But I sort of came to realise...
You know what I'm going to ask you now, right? Is what your view of the voluntary euthanasia law?
Oh, are you going to ask me that?
I thought I might.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? I'm thinking deeply about that. I think that I am in favour, but I think that there are some issues that need to be worked through. I think that's, I'm sort of going to stay slightly on the fence, one leg on the fence.
You mean issues within the law as it's written so far, within the bill?
Well, no, I was just thinking in more
social
generally
issues.
Than that. Yeah, exactly. Mm. You know, it's an area we have to be careful of, but I can certainly see that there are some areas, some instances where euthanasia would be a reasonable thing to be able to offer someone.
Yeah. Sorry, I extracted you from your explanation to put you on the spot for a moment. So you worked in palliative care for a while.
I did, and then I ended up, I was interested in the fact there's so much ill health and cancer in particular, which was preventable, and also I was really concerned about the extent to which we had inequalities and also the narrative around those inequalities, that it was, you know, patients' fault, they weren't doing what they should be doing. And so I trained in public health medicine and cancer research, specifically cancer epidemiology, and then sort of shifted from that into sort of this more policy health systems and health services kind of work. So I've done that both here and internationally. So I've just been doing work looking at cancer control around the Pacific region, for example. There's some really major issues there. So again, trying to strengthen systems so that people are less likely to be affected by cancer or to die from cancer.
There has to be some personal responsibility too, though, right? I mean, this is our narrative about the vaccination situation with measles. It's saying people need to get themselves and their kids vaccinated.
Yeah.
Most of us don't say it's the system's fault because the system has been pushing it so hard.
Yeah, certainly. I would certainly be advocating for everybody to get immunised, certainly. I guess in terms of personal responsibility, personal decisions are made in you know, complex contexts. And I guess what I'm talking about is trying to make those contexts and environment as conducive to making healthy decisions as possible for the individual.
Yeah, I get that. It's a complex subject. Mm. Am I right in calling you the interim cancer czar?
Cancer czar. I don't think I would call myself a cancer czar. I think, look, the thing with cancer is that it's so big and complex. There's no such thing as a cancer expert. You know, it's got to be a group activity because, you know, expertise is very broad. So I'm here to help lead and help create the new structures so that we have a really good foundation for improving our cancer outcomes.
Good. Good luck.
Thank you so
no
much.
No targets.
Oh, well, we are...
Well, you've got the one target that you want to have an equitable outcome for Māori by 2030.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you
Hope
very
it's not
much.
Like Kiwi Builds kind of targets. Just saying.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Dr. Diana Sarfati, who's the new interim national director of cancer control.